Hey, it's Dan Persons with this special episode of Mighty Movie Podcast. John Chris Faluci, the creator of Ren and Stimpy, The Ripping Friends, has a new project going featuring another of his characters, Patriot, Man's Man, and all-around hothead, George Licker. John's got a Kickstarter campaign going and wanted to talk about what it's all about, so I said, hey, why not come on the show? And he did. So, here is our interview. John talks a little bit about the new cartoon, Cans Without Labels, and he talks about a few other choice bits as well. Enjoy. Let's start off a little by talking about George Licker, because he's been with you as a character for a good long time, and people may not know where he came from and what he is to you. So can you explain a little bit about George Licker's origins?
Yeah, he's Ren and Stimpy's master. So when I was first developing Ren and Stimpy, George Licker was part of the original pitch. And when I finally sold Ren and Stimpy to Nickelodeon, they didn't want me to use George Licker. I think because... I don't know. It was weird. It was mostly women that I was dealing with, and they were all afraid of George Licker. They thought he was a real live person, and that I was promoting his behavior. And really, it's just kind of making fun of that sort of stern, disciplinarian, right-wing kind of father figure, kind of like what Archie Bunker was in All in the Family.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't condoning Archie's beliefs and his behavior and stuff like that. They were just using it as entertainment. You know, everybody knows some character, something like that, and you can identify with it, whether you agree with the character or whether you make fun of the character. It works both ways. Mm-hmm. And George Licker's kind of like that.
So let's talk a bit about what you're doing with him now. You've started up a Kickstarter campaign for this cartoon, Cans Without Labels. And what's going on here? George Licker is coming back, apparently, with a vengeance, isn't he?
Yeah. I mean, I've got a ton of George Licker stories written already. It's as developed as The Simpsons. It just hasn't... been on television, you know, outside of the couple of episodes he was in with Ren and Stimpy.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I've got the whole backstory. I've got tons of stories written. I've got storyboards done. And I'm dying to do the series.
Mm-hmm.
So when I discovered Kickstarter, I thought maybe this is a good way to do one of the episodes that we've already drawn. Mm-hmm. It just needs to be animated, colored, and... have the sound effects and music edited in. That's Cans Without Labels.
Hmm. So why did you pick this particular episode? Well, apparently it was already in process, right?
It was very far along because we'd already drawn all the layouts, and the layouts are drawn by Jim Smith, one of my partners on Ren and Stimpy, one of the big guns, one of the big shots.
Hmm. So what is this cartoon then?
Well, it's about... it's about one aspect of George Licker's frugality. You know, George, like my dad, grew up in harder, tougher times than we grew up. You know, we have everything done for us today. We had allowances when we were kids. You know, we think that the world is ready to give us a hand up. Whereas our dads think differently. At least my dad did, and George Licker does. He thinks you have to earn your keep. And when you do earn some money, you need to save as much of it as you can and put it away for a rainy day. So George Licker is always on the hunt for bargains. He never likes to pay full price for anything. He waits for sales, and he doesn't buy brand name products. And one of his favorite bargains ever is marked down damaged merchandise, particularly cans that don't have labels. And he buys those at the supermarket for about 5 or 10 cents each. And he thinks that's great. And the fact that you don't know what's in the can is even more exciting to him, because he gets to guess. But it's always something horrible. This actually happened when I was a kid. My dad used to collect cans without labels, and he built shelves in the basement where he stored them all. And he was ready for the big one, you know? He couldn't wait for the hydrogen bomb to fall, because he was going to be ready. He could laugh at all his neighbors who were out there frying in the fallout. But we'd be in our basement, in our bomb shelter, with our cans without labels, able to survive for, 10 years until the fallout dissipates. The problem was, not knowing what was in the cans, he'd bring them upstairs thinking we were going to have a treat for lunch, and he'd open a can up, and it would be something completely gruesome. But the thing is, once he opened a can, there was no such thing as waste in our house. He had to use everything. So even if it did turn out to be something hideous, which it always did, we had to eat it anyways. And that's the story of Cans Without Labels with George Licker. He brings his little nephews over, Slab and Ernie, that live next door, and he tells them for the first time, he introduces them to the thrill of a can without a label. And they quickly learn that it's not so thrilling. Mm-hmm. It's the kind of thrill ride that you don't want to, that you want to get off once you've started it, but there's no turning back.
Is it an escalation of awfulness that we're going to be seeing here?
Yeah, pretty much, yeah. It's like when, Rancid used to have these kind of very intense adventures that would build and build and build, and it was kind of like a roller coaster ride. It's like you didn't really want to, you wanted to get off, but you didn't want to get off. And even if you did, you couldn't. So that's what this is like.
As a tangential question, it just struck me, has anybody ever analyzed where all these nephews come from in cartoons?
I always wondered about it when I was a kid. But, I love a lot of the weird cartoon traditions that don't make any sense. And I happily adopt them, knowing that they don't make sense. Those live-action shows, a lot of live-action sitcoms were like that, too, single-parent ones. Back in the day when it was evil to be a single parent. My Three Sons. There was a dad, and you always wondered, where the hell's mom? I think there was a whole bunch of those shows in the 60s, weren't there?
Yeah, there were. There were a ton of them. Doris Day, all of those.
Okay, then. Yeah, and that was back when, they thought you would go to hell if you raised a kid alone. Yet sitcoms were full of these single-parent things. Maybe they stole it from Carl Barks. in some of the cartoons, you don't know who their parents are. Like Popeye's three nephews, they're not Olive's nephews. They're not Popeye's kids.
Mm-hmm.
Donald Duck, the same thing. Huey, Dewey, and Louie. Who owns those
exactly kids?
It's
also a little suspect that they all look like the characters to begin with.
They all look exactly like the characters. They're clones. Cartoons were ahead of the scientific community. They were cloning characters long before it was actually possible.
Mm-hmm. So, you were one of the people who really was involved in the rebirth of cartoons with Ren and Stimpy, and also prior to that, Beanie and Cecil and Mighty Mouse. And, how has your philosophy of cartooning, how have you seen it spread across the industry, or have you? And what do you think is still lacking? What needs to be done?
Well, when I got in the business, nothing was cartoony. Hmm. The age of cartooning and animated cartoons was pretty much dead, really. I mean, nobody was doing it. All the Saturday morning cartoons were really stiff and bland. And there was nothing animated in them. They were all just tracing model sheets and things like that. The few animated features that existed when I came into business were all pretty much the same. There were, there was the Don Bluth movies, a couple of Disney movies, which is pretty much the same thing. Mm-hmm. And there were scattered here and there some imitation Disney movies by independent sources. Mm-hmm. And none of those were funny or anything. They're all, meant to be like 101 Dalmatians, kind of realistic humans or whatever. Even if they were animals, they all moved the same and they all talked the same. And they didn't do magic. Like old cartoons were magic, right? They did impossible things. And the cartoons in the 80s did not do impossible things. In fact, if you tried to do anything impossible, you'd get yelled at or fired or whatever. They'd completely forgotten the cartoon's roots. But I never did. And, you know, had I thought that for the rest of my life, cartoons were never going to get beyond Saturday morning cartoon thinking, I probably would have got out of it. And most people of my generation did think it was never coming back. Mm. But I was determined, you know. I was an idiot optimist or something. I kept thinking, no, you know, somebody's going to finally buy one of these shows. I mean, as soon as they see some funny stuff, they're going to say, why are we putting this crap on the air all the time? You know, luckily John and his friends came along and finally reminded us that we should be doing stuff that's fun. But it took about 9 years before I finally sold Ren and Stimpy. But we did have the Stepping Stones. And the Stepping Stones were basically my first stint on the Jetsons. Hmm. It was my stint on the Jetsons, where I got to supervise the layouts on 15 episodes of the new crappy Jetsons. But that was where I tested out a new system of doing layouts, where we listened to the soundtracks. We actually listened to the dialogue tracks and drew all the poses, not according to the model sheets, but according to what we heard in the voices. I mean, the characters looked like the characters. You could tell it was George and Jane and Judy and Elroy and Astro. But we didn't just trace the model sheets, and that's what everyone else was doing at the time. Instead, I sat down and listened to each. I had cassette tapes made of George O'Hanlon and Janet Waldo and all the actors, and I specifically listened to every single syllable and inflection in the track readings, and I drew the characters making those expressions and those poses. So So the poses in those Jetsons cartoons were custom made, which was a complete radical departure from what was going on at the time. And then when I did Mighty Mouse with Ralph Bakshi, now I wasn't just in charge of layout, I was in charge of the whole studio and the whole studio system. So I completely revamped the whole process of how cartoons were made. And I hearkened back to Looney Tunes, to the unit system at Looney Tunes. Hmm. So instead of having an assembly line, like what was happening at Hanna-Barbera and Filmation and Deke and all these companies, we had a director system where the director would follow the story through from beginning to end. There were no department heads. We didn't have a storyboard department. We didn't have a layout department. We didn't have a voice director. You know, the director did everything. The director supervised the story. He supervised the storyboards. He worked with the layout artists. He directed the voices himself. And, you know, it's amazing that we were able to do that, because that went against everything that was considered holy at that time. And the only reason we were able to do it is Ralph kept the network people off our backs. He protected us. You know, and he came from the period where the cartoonists were in charge. His first job he ever had was at Terry Toons, working on Mighty Mouse cartoons. And even though it was kind of the end of that era, they were still producing the cartoons with cartoonists in charge. Mm-hmm. So he remembered all this, and of course when he did his own features, he directed them and he was totally in charge. So the whole concept to him of modern Saturday morning cartoons wouldn't have made sense anyways, the whole assembly line thing. So when I said, let's do the unit system and let's, you know, have the director follow everything through, he just went for it right away, and he managed to convince CBS to let us do it that way. So that was the first time in decades that cartoonists were completely in charge of the creative process again. We had no script writers. The cartoonists wrote the stories. Hmm. We wrote them on scripts, which we didn't want to do, but we couldn't convince. That was the one thing we couldn't convince CBS of letting us do, was write the stories on the storyboards. But at least it was cartoonists writing the stories. So, yeah, that was really the show that was the turning point. 2 years later, when we did Ren and Stimpy for Nickelodeon, Jerry Laybourne, the head of Nickelodeon, coined the phrase creator-driven cartoons. Hmm. And they marketed that as if it was a new invention. And really, that's like saying creator-driven painting. Why wouldn't a creator create the painting? You don't have a writer write your painting and then you follow the description. Hmm. It was just a return to sense, to logic. But it seemed to everyone, it seemed like it was some kind of radical new invention. It wasn't. We just returned back to our roots.
So is Cans with Labels following in that tradition now?
Oh, yeah. I storyboarded it myself, just on lined paper. And then Jim and I did the layouts. Yeah, there were, you know, we did it completely. Nobody but cartoonists created any of it. And that will be true to the end of the process. I mean, we do our own sound editing. I direct the voices. I directed Mike Pataki. This was one of his last recordings before he died.
Well, yeah. That's the other thing, is that Mike Pataki did pass away after recording this. Presuming that this is going forward, what will you do in the future?
I guess I'll do the voice myself. Which, you know, I wish that we had Mike. I miss Mike like crazy. He was a hilarious guy and a great actor, super talented. But, you know, if I have to do more George Lucas, I guess it'd be me. It'd be second best.
You know, it used to be with Ren and Stimpy and Ripping Friends and those, you did the layouts, and then you were shipping them off to Korea and you were shipping them off to Canada. I take it this is going to be a more of an in-house thing. Is that right?
Yeah, although I have a few animators and assistants around the world now. It's not the same thing as, like, I'm not sending it to a big studio of people who don't care, and that's the typical situation. It wasn't the situation when we used Carbuncle, that's for sure. But that was a Canadian studio run by friends of mine who were great animators, and, you know, they put as much care into their end as we did on our end. But that was the exception. You know, normally you send stuff to Asia to some giant studio, and you have no idea who it is that's working on your show. And each animator does one or two scenes, and then they go off and do some other show, so they never get used to your style, and they don't have time to, you know, to put their own personal stamp on it. And that just doesn't work with my system. So it's much better that that people around the world, cartoonists around the world, find me and they send me their work, and if it looks like that it'll fit within the style and context of what I'm doing, then I hire them. So we have a virtual studio. We've got a few people here and then a few people around the world.
Is it because of digital that this can be done? People essentially have their own in-house studio?
Yes, we have the internet, and we have email, and we have Skype, and we have TeamViewer. So if you put all those things together, I'm able to work with people all over the place.
So let's get down to it. People are listening to this and saying, wow, sounds like fun. How can I help?
Well, they can support the cartoons on Kickstarter. They can help me get it produced. That's the main thing is that now you have direct access with the audience. I mean, you remember when I was doing those first internet cartoons?
Oh yeah.
Back in 1997, right? I was predicting then that there was going to be a revolution in distribution overnight, and it didn't happen right overnight. But it seems like all the elements are there now where it could happen, where you could finally put all this together. The fact that now you have direct access with the audience, and the audience is actually funding projects they like, that's an amazing revolution. There's only one piece I see that's missing still, and that's getting sponsors to directly sponsor your cartoons, to produce the cartoons in the way that entertainment used to be on television, where a sponsor just attached its name to your show, paid for the show, and in return, the performers and the writers would create the commercials in the same style that the show was being created, and that was a way of making commercials that everyone liked. That the audience actually liked the commercials in the Jack Benny show or in the Huckleberry Hound show. They, you know, if they were doing shows like that today, nobody would fast forward through the commercials. And it's strange to me that commercials even exist on TV anymore because nobody's watching them.
Mm.
And the sponsors haven't figured out that they've got the internet. They could directly sponsor things again, just like how television was born, how radio was born. They could have total control again over the commercials. And they're wasting tons of money on these giant ad agencies who come up with commercials that everyone hates, that cost a fortune to place on television channels all over the world. For a fraction of that money, when you think about how much money a big company will spend on a commercial and putting it on, getting it on the air, they'll spend millions and millions on it. Well, that's more than it costs to make the whole show. It's crazy. Just pay for the show, the production of the show, and hire the writers and the director to make your commercials and use the stars to pitch the products. It's like the perfect solution. The audience likes it. The producers like it. The sponsor likes it. It's three pieces to the puzzle. And all three pieces are happy without having to go through thousands of middlemen who don't care about any of either three of those tiers.
Where is Matty Mattel now that we really need him?
Yeah, exactly. Everything's too bureaucratic and huge and soulless now.
Mm.
There's no humans behind anything anymore.
So before we go, what are you watching now? I mean, which cartoons do you feel are carrying the torch forward?
I have no idea. I watch UFC, and I watch TCM. I watch all the classic movies on TCM, and I watch nature shows.
Mm.
Anything else? If I want to watch cartoons, I watch my DVDs and my VHS, old cartoons.
Okay.
So I don't even know what's, you know, I peripherally know kind of what's going on, but I don't really watch any modern stuff. I'm too retro. I like the past and I like the future, but I don't like now. Except for UFC. UFC is the only thing that I think has real soul anymore.
I've never touched it myself.
Oh, it's the greatest. It just completely goes right for your basest instincts. Unfiltered. It's just great.
John, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Dan.
So if you do want to support this new cartoon from the man who helped make cartoons funny again, you can go to Kickstarter.com and search for John K. or Cans Without Labels. And I'll put the pitch video and a link to the campaign over at MightyMoviePodcast.com. Lots of wonderful prizes you can get for pledging, and it's just a worthy cause, don't you think? I do. Thanks for listening. Have fun. This has been a production of Upstart Company NYC, copyright 2012, Dan Persons, all rights reserved, no unauthorized duplication permitted.